What I had in mind for today is to talk about the habit of contentment. The subject of contentment's been on my mind, my heart this last week. It's partly because last week I was sick, as some of you probably noticed. I was quite sick in that I had an abscess on my tonsil, and so it was kind of painful, and for a while I couldn't open my mouth. And I wouldn't want to live through it again, except that every time I've gotten sick for more than just like a day or two, when the time it's over, midway through or something, I'm also really grateful that I've gotten sick that way, because there's a way in which then I have permission just to take a vacation and not do anything at all, and just to read a book or look out the window or nap or whatever. And it seems that whenever I get sick that way, it also often feels like this is what I need to do anyway. It's like, finally, I'm so stubborn, right? So I need something like that to stop me, to just stop and just have this vacation. The rest, stop. And so it was quite lovely last week. And the sentiments of contentment after the pain passed away, what I was left with was a lot of feelings of contentment. I was really content being at home and being very simple, not having anything to do, no Dharma talks to give. And I was reminded of how important the sentiment of contentment has been for me in my life, and how I feel contentment is a very important element of Buddhist practice. I had one anecdote about contentment. I don't know if that's the right word, but I remembered this last week that when I was a teenager, maybe 16, 17, 18. That I had some interest, I don't know how serious it was, but I had some interest, recurring interest, in entering a Catholic monastery. And it was, a little bit odd for an atheist to live in and become a monk. I wasn't going to tell them I was an atheist. But it was the only place I knew at my young age where I could live a certain kind of life, a certain kind of contentment, or peace, or rest, or I think contentment is the best word, kind of a fullness of being that expresses itself in kind of contentment. And my idea of Catholic monastic life and monasteries I visited in Europe growing up was somehow that it was imbued in the walls or in the gardens and in the, this feeling of just kind of being settled and contented in that life. So eventually I discovered Buddhism, so I didn't have to become a monk under false pretenses, a Catholic monk. The Buddha spoke often about on the topic of contentment, and as many of you know, the Buddha laid out a path, a gradual path of practice that people were kind of meant to follow. Different steps, it's kind of a step-like approach to practice, and you start at the kind of doing fundamental kind of basic kind of practices, and then within the foundation of that you can do more advanced practices, and you build and build and build on that. And so for example, ethics, and getting your ethical life together and living a virtuous life, not causing other people harm, is one of the most fundamental things you need to get in order before it makes sense to do more advanced spiritual practices. And one of the things that part of this gradual approach to practice that the Buddha offered was the idea of contentment, and was considered relatively early in the sequence of practice. But to cultivate some sense of contentment as part of your practice life, your spiritual life. The place where this contentment is most clearly talked about is the four contentments of the monastics. It said that a monastic person, a monk or a nun, is content with the food they receive, with the clothes that they have, the lodgings that they're provided with, and the medicine that they need. Those are the four contentments of a monastic. In ancient India, the context for religious practice, serious spiritual practice, was that most people would do ascetic practices. A lot of very strong self-denying practices, where they'd starve themselves for long periods, or go around naked, or stand in the blazing sun, or meditate in the freezing cold, or all kinds of everything, so fairly extreme. And the Buddha, in the context of his time, offered what was called a middle path. And for us in our modern kind of lifestyle, the middle path that he designed for his monastics seemed pretty ascetic to us. But it was specifically designed, it was specifically designed so that people, the monastics, had just enough requisites for their life that they could take care of their life in a responsible way. They would have just enough clothes so that they could, protect them from heat or cold or flies or insects as was needed. But not, they weren't supposed to have, you know, this abundant wardrobe, you know, full of many, many kind of different shades of maroon or robes. And just enough food to satisfy the needs of the body, not to have these huge, you know, feasts where they can gorge themselves with food, or not to have these huge stockpiles of food waiting in the background, but rather just enough so they could, you know, take care of their body, so the body can function, they can meditate, and just live their life following the dedicated life that they're committing themselves to. And the same thing with lodgings. The Buddha said you don't have to go out and just live in the, you know, under a tree. You don't have to go avoid lodgings entirely. But also you don't want to go live in some great big, the expression nowadays is a house on steroids. These monster homes that that people build in our neighborhoods. But rather you have a lodging that just provides what you need for your well-being, so that you're taken care of, but doesn't provide, so that you can continue in a matter-of-fact way with your spiritual practice and discipline, and it's conducive to a healthy, straightforward life. Not overindulging and not underindulging, but just kind of a matter-of-fact simplicity to it. And then the same thing with medicine. Rather than avoiding medicine, the Buddha said, we allowed the monks to have medicine, and because the important thing was to take care of oneself, but not to overdo it. So the idea being that monastics were supposed to be content with just enough of these things so that they can be healthy, to live a healthy life. And it lends itself to a kind of simplicity of living, which then optimizes the opportunities for pursuing what was most important for the monastics. And this is a question whether you want to follow the traditional Buddhist goal of enlightenment or freedom or not. A very important question in anyone's life is, do you have a really clear idea of what's most important for you? And are you really willing to get behind and really dedicate yourself to some degree to what is most important to you? Or is there a tendency in your life to have something maybe you feel is important, but then to have it diluted by being interested in too many different things and pursuing many, many different things, but not really being able to focus in a serious way, dedicated way, on what is most important? I think that I have a sense that any real mature approach to life requires having some sense of what is most important and letting some things go, because we can't do everything. I think especially mature life in our modern life, where there's just so many opportunities to do so much, and so much, so many messages, that it's important to do it all. So this is one quote I wanted to read where the Buddha talked about this kind of monastic contentment. And how is a monastic contented? Here, a monastic is satisfied with a robe to protect the body, with alms to satisfy the stomach. And having accepted sufficient alms, he or she goes on her way. Just as a bird with wings flies hither and thither, burdened by nothing but its wings, so is the monastic satisfied. Isn't that kind of a nice image? That if you can be satisfied with little, just enough to really take care of your life, what's really needed, you can really be light and you can fly through your life like a bird. Imagine, you know, a bird if it had a suitcase. It wouldn't get very far. So when I was in Burma, I was ordained as a monk. And while I was there ordained as a monk, there was a... well, at the same time, with an American who was ordained with me together. And he did not understand very well this notion of being contented with just enough to take care of oneself. And he had a number of suitcases. He came with a number of suitcases with him to Burma. And one suitcase was full of vitamins and nutritional supplements. This huge thing, if thing. And because it was kind of medicine, he was allowed to keep that when he became a monk. But he had this huge thing about food. And food represented much more than just nutriment for the body. But food also was a source of security, of well-being, of safety. And monastics are not allowed to keep any food beyond 12 o'clock noon. They have to give up. Any food they're given in the morning, they have to give up. And it means that when they wake up the next morning, they don't know whether they have any food or not, because they haven't kept any. They don't put it in their closet and wait. But rather, they wake up the next morning and they see if anybody wants to offer them food. So he was particularly attached to papayas. And so he was quite distraught when he became ordained, because, you know, well, how is he going to be sure he's going to get enough papayas to... And he went through a lot of contortions to try to figure out, you know, how he can get his papayas. And so finally what he figured out was that Ruth Dennison's husband was there practicing on the retreat. And at 11:59 every morning, he would take his hoard of papayas down to Henry Dennison and give it to him. And the implicit understanding was that that Henry would offer them back in the morning. So this is technically not exactly kosher in Buddhist monastic circles. But it was an example of someone who had still to learn being contented with little, or being contented with just enough. So monastics are trained to cultivate a habit of contentment. And it even goes beyond the idea of, you know, necessarily always getting enough to satisfy your appetite. Being content with what you're given, what happens to you in your daily life. And that can mean that you're content with, you know, whatever, pluses and minuses. I wanted to read this account. This is a poem written by one of the earliest Buddhist monastics, one of the disciples of the Buddha, I suppose. Maybe it kind of expresses this to some degree. When the storm clouds thunder in the sky, and the flyways of the birds are awash with torrential rains, then monastics who have entered a cave meditate. No greater pleasure than this can be found. When on the flower-shrouded bank of a river bedecked with various woodland plants, the monastic sits on the bank, joyfully meditating. No greater pleasure than this can be found. When at night, in a lonely grove, with rain pouring down, and fanged and tusked animals roar, the monastics who have entered a cave, meditate. No greater pleasure than this can be found. So somehow being contented with whatever's occurring, whether it's big storms or beautiful kind of pastoral settings, or whether it's danger, you know, frightening groves in the dark, somehow through the meditation, they cultivate this practice of being contented and finding pleasure in their meditation, free of the being independent to some degree of the conditions around them. Can we find a contentment? Can we develop a habit of contentment? I made a lunch date with an old, kind of a long-time Vipassana student for this Thursday. And at coming into town from away, flying into town. And so now my son is sick. So there's not a family thing, right? And when you have little kids, it kind of goes in circles. And so I thought, well, you know, the way it works in these family things, you know, if he's sick today, and who knows where I'll be on Thursday. So I said, you know, you better call me Thursday morning when you arrive in the airport. And she said, oh yeah, I'll call you, but you know, I don't want you to be sitting there at the restaurant waiting for me. She said, oh, you know, that's okay. We'll just sit there. We'll be, you know, it's quite nice to sit there in the restaurant in Palo Alto, and we'll just have dinner and lunch without you. And you know, if you don't show up, that's okay with us. And somehow she was expressing this kind of this. You know, she wasn't going to be put off. She wasn't her well-being, her happiness and joy in life wasn't going to be. She wasn't going to feel distraught or angry or upset based on my absence. She would be delighted. She wanted to meet with me. She asked for the lunch date, but she was kind of. She had a little bit different approach to what it meant if I didn't show up than most people would have. She was prepared to be content with the situation as it unfolded. Contentment is not just simply a state of mind, but it's also an embodied feeling. It's a feeling, it's a sentiment that we can feel. In other places, the Buddha talks about the monastic contentment, this contentment that the monastics can feel. And he talked about it as being a blameless bliss. And the kind of bliss can come with from contentment, the kind of simplicity of life, the unburdened nature of life. It can be kind of a bliss. And in my sense of contentment that I feel for myself, it is something that's embodied. It's a feeling tone or a sentiment in my body itself. There's a kind of fullness in my torso often when I feel content. There's a kind of feeling of rest, of peace. There's a feeling of kind of resting in my weight, rather than kind of perched forward and kind of lifting up off my weight in a way we are sometimes if we're anxious or driven. Kind of with our the weight of our body, and kind of be rested in it, rested in our place. So this idea of fullness of being and rested in being are kind of some of the sentiments I associate with feeling of contentment. And there are many emotions that come along with Buddhist practice, and I think of Buddhist practice as being to some degree involved with a emotional signposts that kind of encourage us along our way. And but if we're going to feel the emotional aspects that come with practice, it means we have to have some sensitivity to what our embodied experience is. If we're rushing ahead in our thoughts and rushing ahead in our life doing too many things and don't pay attention, feel what's going on in our body, we feel there's very little opportunity to discover some of the signposts and encouragements that the body will give us as we go along in our practice. So of course there are different kinds of contentment, and one kind of contentment is the kind of contentment maybe that most people want, which is the contentment that comes when our desires are fulfilled. Wouldn't that be nice? And it would be nice, of course, if we fulfill all our desires, perhaps. But it's not so realistic. But aside from the unrealistic aspect, you know, I mean, I don't know how kind of desires most of you have, but I suspect that a good percentage of you, if you were able to fulfill every possible desire, you know, you probably wouldn't be physically possible for the universe to provide you with enough goods and activities and stuff to really fulfill all the possible desires some of you might have. But one of the awkward things about fulfillment of desires Not that it's not necessarily a bad thing, but there are certain desires which, when they get satisfied, actually strengthen further desires. And so it puts us sometimes on a treadmill of developing more and more desires. And in that, we're looking sometimes beyond ourselves to satisfy our desire. There's sometimes a tendency and desire to alienate ourselves from ourselves. If, for example, our desire is trying to fill some kind of insecurity or void or emptiness within us, and we're trying to escape from that emptiness, that void or insecurity, then we're separating from ourselves, we're alienated from ourselves, and that itself feels bad, creates even more feeling of discomfort or discontent. And so even if we have some success in fulfilling our desire, we're more alienated from ourselves. And so then we have even more motivation to try to, you know, eat more or have more, buy more, or whatever the desire might be. There's this wonderful story, of a Mullah Nasruddin's story, where he lives next to a very wealthy man who's always dining in great, wonderful, luxurious feasts. And this wealthy man is considered to be very wise. And Mullah Nasruddin lives next door in a little kind of hovel and eats beans and rice every day. And one day the wealthy neighbor comes to Mullah and says, "You know, if you would just learn how to flatter the king, you'd be able to live like I live. You'd be able to have great feasts every day." And Mullah says, "If you would learn to live on beans and rice, you wouldn't have to flatter the king." So the second kind of desire is the desire, second kind of contentment is the contentment that comes with having few desires. Or to have desires that don't have that kind of neurotic punch behind them, that they, you know, they were driven and have to be fulfilled at all costs. Well, the other thing that the fulfillment of our desires, one of the kind of problems that might arise if our desires are fulfilled, is that often our desires are not just simply sensual desires, but their desires are sometimes tied in, connected to beliefs we have about ourselves, beliefs we have about the world. And so the fulfillment of some desires might reinforce, strengthen unhealthy beliefs, beliefs that aren't really true and helpful for us. So, for example, we have various beliefs about the point of life. The point of life is to have fulfilled desires. You know, just to have, you know, that have the more desires you have fulfilled, the more successful you are in life. And so if you have some desires fulfilled, you might actually strengthen that belief. And that's a surefire formula for suffering. Some people think the point of life is to create optimum amounts of security. And so they have desire to create security around them and order. But security is not assured. There's no guarantee there's ultimate security in this life that we live. But if you're successful in creating some security, it might give a person the false impression that they have something really that they can rely on. So what are some of the desires that people pursue that maybe are not so reliable, that actually can lead to actually further discontent rather than more contentment? Do you know about the 8 worldly dharmas? The great list that Buddhism has. I call them, the great 8 great winds, which batter our minds kind of back and forth and kind of we lose our bearings, lose our stability. Pleasure and pain, gain and loss, praise and blame, fame and disgrace. People are preoccupied with for example, fame and disgrace. That's really important for them. They're setting themselves up to be blown about. Someone criticizes you, and you're blown one way, and you react. Someone praises you, and you get blown another way. You get puffed up a little bit for a while. Praise and blame, fame and disgrace, gain and loss, success and failure, pleasure and pain. Is there an alternative to having a life that's concerned with these kinds of rewards or these kinds of results in our life. And there is. And I think the point, one of the points of Buddhist practice, one of the points of meditation, is to begin to discover that there's other things that in life that might be much more satisfying and more important than a chasing after pleasure or pain, success and failure, gain and loss, praise and blame, fame and disgrace. Part of discovering contentment is to understand that suffering, annoyance, tragedy is part of what life involves. That in order to look at life as a whole and not to pretty it up and look at it with blinders, we see that irritation, annoyance, frustration, tragedies are part of the whole. And it isn't that we're supposed to kind of just get out of the way so that they not try to avoid them, our tragedies in our life, or take care of them. But if we have some belief system that these things don't belong in our life, then that very belief system is going to cause us extra suffering. And I think part of the beauty, one of the ways that Buddhist teachings have been so helpful for many people, is that Buddhist teaching has really stresses that suffering is really a central element in human life. And to deny that is to cause more suffering. And some people, when they hear these teachings on suffering in the Buddhist context, sometimes will sigh a great sigh of relief. Finally, someone's admitting it. To be discontented because life involves some kind of suffering perhaps is not understanding the nature of life. To cultivate the habit of contentment in the midst of irritation and frustration might be a very mature thing to do. Have you ever been late for an appointment, stuck in rush hour traffic, and try to cultivate contentment? Try it. Why not? Why couldn't you be contented in that situation? What keeps you from being contented in that situation? You might look as you go through your daily life, look at different particular points in the day where you feel most discontented, most agitated and upset, and really study and get to know what's going on there. See, is there inherently any reason not to feel at peace or at rest at this particular moment? So the question then that we come to then is, how do we cultivate contentment? If it's a useful for spiritual practice, if it's useful and helpful in our life. Do we want to cultivate it? Actually, I was surprised so many of you came here tonight, because tonight is the second part of the PBS documentary on the suffrage movement. I saw the first half yesterday. Not that everybody would stay home and watch the second part. I was so inspired by the courage and the phenomenal energy. You know, they talked about it last night as the suffrage movement being revolutionary, creating a real revolution. And I never heard that word connected to the suffrage movement, but it certainly sounded like it. Phenomenal revolution, seemingly orchestrated initially by two women, tireless women. So I thought about that. I'm going to talk about contentment. How many women in our society have been told, you just be content with your lot, be content with the way things are? Does that sound familiar to some women? So that's not the kind of contentment we're talking about right here. Just kind of accept your drudgery, accept your difficulty in that way. How to cultivate contentment? Certainly in a very kind of simple, practical way. Don't do too much. Don't be too busy. Busyness does a tremendous violence to our soul, to our inner life. Value contentment itself. I knew I wanted to talk about contentment, and I didn't know if I had so much to say about the topic. So now I'll look through some of my books and see. Certainly, I'll find some books that talk about contentment. I couldn't find any. And so maybe it's not a particularly popular topic, or maybe it's not so obvious that it's important. I wonder if those of you who are therapists in the room, is helping your clients become more contented kind of in the forefront of your minds? I don't know. Anyway. So valuing contentment, having some real appreciation for it, some understanding of it. I value it, and I think it's very important. And for me, at various points where my practice has deepened, more often than not, it's been preceded by stages of contentment. Contentment is like this foundation that allows me to go deeper into my practice. So valuing it, valuing contentment, peace, ease of being, over pursuing the 8 worldly dharmas. So the second, how to cultivate contentment, I suggest you meditate, be mindful. Meditation is great. Both very simply to relax, but more profoundly to understand more clearly, to see more clearly what's actually going on with us. But relaxation isn't to be knocked. It's pretty helpful. It's difficult to be content if you're not relaxed. The third thing is, and this is really where clear seeing is important, and really part of the heart of mindfulness practice as we teach it, is to look at discontent squarely in the face. If you to really be honest about when you're discontented, and rather than pursuing contentment so much, the tendency in Vipassana practice, at least I think a very valuable principle, is not so much to chase after the ideal, but to really be mindful, investigate what gets in the way of it. So rather than learning how to live without fear, really study your fear. Rather than learning to live without desire, really study your desire. Then you'll learn to live without desire, neurotic desire. If you want to be contented, really study your discontent. Become really familiar with what it feels like in your body to be discontented, in your mind to be discontented. What are the conditions, the mental belief systems, what are the emotional reactions of the mind that lead to discontent? Look at it really squarely in the face. There is both, as you do that, you'll discover there's both wise and unwise discontent. And I don't want to give you the impression here that all discontent is problematic. People who are very serious about doing Buddhist practice, part of them, they're a discontented lot. You need to have a certain level of healthy discontent in order to really be motivated and fueled to practice. But hopefully it's a healthy discontent that goes with a strong level of contentment at the same time. And maybe if I go talk a little bit further, I'll explain what I mean by that. But to be discontented because you haven't been able to buy that Ferrari yet. I mean, I don't know if that doesn't qualify as healthy discontent. But to be discontented with the fact that you feel that there's there's some real contraction in this. You feel some real contraction or fear or tightness or suffering or neurosis or anxiety somehow deep down in the core of your being. And you're discontented with that being there. You're not going to say, accept that and just kind of go along with it, let it be there, kind of swing, but irritating your innards. But you're actually discontented with it being there, not in a way that you kind of add more suffering on top of you, but discontent in the sense that it kind of excites you or fuels you or energizes you. Let's get to the heart of this. Let's go deeper and look at it. Can I resolve this also? Can I dissolve this also? So looking at discontent squarely in the face, and when it's unwise discontent, maybe resolving that. When it's wise discontent, maybe there's ways of using that to fuel us to practice more seriously and diligently. The fourth way is to look contentment squarely in the face. There are times in our life when we do feel contented, and they're great. And to learn to appreciate that, and to honor it, to respect it. Wholesome states of mind, wholesome states of being, are strengthened by our appreciation of them, by our clear seeing and recognition of them. But also, it's important to look at our contentment clearly in the face, see it clearly, investigate it, because there can be unwise contentment. Just as there can be wise and unwise discontent, there can be wise and unwise contentment. Certain kinds of contentment can be dead end, or even unhelpful. If someone's praises me to no end, tell me what a great person I am, and I feel, and I leave feeling so contented, you know, I'm going to bask in that contentment for a while. That's not a very helpful contentment to have, because the degree to which I bask in that contentment, I'm actually fueling the egotism that has to be there, that in order to, you know, receive in a kind of unhealthy way that praise. That makes sense what I said? So all contentment is not wise, but some contentment is. So we need to really see and study our contentment when it's there also. Helpful contentment is not an end where we rest. Contentment is not an end where we rest. Contentment is a part of the path of practice. And it's a beautiful part of the aspect of the path, because it corresponds or resonates with the end of practice, the goal of practice. The ultimate peace that's possible through practice has a lot of complementary qualities to it, to the contentment that can be possible earlier on in practice. But that contentment supports us to look more deeply. And I believe, and my experience has been, and this is why I said earlier that often when I've gone deeper into my practice, it's often, I've moved into a new stage of practice, is often preceded by a level of contentment. Is that as I stayed present for my contentment, in the core of it, or in the core of my being, or kind of deeper down inside, if I was really honest, the contentment allowed me to see that there was still some discontent. There was still something, some fear or attachment or holding or insecurity that was still kind of operating and motivating my life. And the contentment was kind of like a foundation, a window that allowed me to see that deeper level of core issues that needed to be resolved, and encouraged me then to continue more deeply, to look more deeply, and to look more deeply, and but from a contented place. Isn't that nice? From a contented place, from a place that feels that our life is, is blameless, a place where we feel our life is, maybe we can even feel that our inherent self-worth is not even dependent on attaining anything in our practice. Wouldn't that be great to have that kind of contentment? That you're doing this practice, but your inherent self-worth is not dependent on what you attain? Isn't that great? So from that contentment then, to honestly and diligently listen to the core of our heart, our heart's innermost request, which is that we release the heart. That we release the heart from the absolute subtlest kernels of what binds it, or what keeps it attached, what keeps it involved in suffering. And once you've done that, then you don't need to be contented anymore. So I hope this talk tonight puts this word contentment in your mind, so that it kind of percolates and bounces around a little bit in your brain, your mind, and your heart, and gives you something to reflect on and something to be on the lookout for, and maybe even something to feel and appreciate. And I don't think it's easy to feel contentment. And I don't want to give that impression here tonight. But if you don't feel contentment, if you feel a lot of discontent, then you come to the right practice. Because the practice then is to really be present for that discontent and see if you can get to the root of it. So may all of us be contented as we drive home. Thank you all.